I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
Global honors for Bob Dylan, the people's poet, the rock and roll fantasy man, could remind you of his pal Linda Ronstadt's line that the American pop song is the greatest gift this country ever presented to the world. Nina Simone and Hank Williams songs, as Dylan himself would remind you. Marvin Gaye and Gershwin songs. Motown and My Fair Lady songs. Irving Berlin and Billie Holiday songs. But Bob Dylan is the only one of our songwriters ever to win a Nobel Prize, and for literature, no less. For feats of language, even before he put them to music and went out and sang them. We're getting a lot of Bob Dylan's reading of himself this hour, but first and last, our close listening is with Sir Christopher Ricks. He's the editor of the Oxford Book of English Verse, star professor at Boston University, born into the landscape of giants, Shakespeare, Tennyson, Wordsworth, T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, and no relation, Hibbing, Minnesota's Bob Dylan, who is today, Rick says, the greatest living user of the English language. Christopher Ricks gave his first radio talk on Bob Dylan 50 years ago after an almost accidental but careful listening to Desolation Row.
My wife and I went out for dinner with friends, and at a certain point they said, we're going to put the lights out and listen to a song, and they played Desolation Row. Mm. Now, I'd heard Dylan before, but I hadn't listened to him. There are certain artists where hearing them isn't at odds with listening them. You might do a bit of both. Dylan, I think you should either listen to or not have it on.
Was it a sudden thing?
It wasn't an epiphany. I can see you were longing to say the word epiphany. I'm afraid it wasn't one of those. It was just, I thought this is a hell of a good song. I'd never sat in a darkened room listening to it carefully and realizing quite how much Mr. T.S. Eliot meant to it.
I'm wondering about that moment when you thought, wait a sec, this is a poet we're listening to.
Well, I didn't quite think that. I just thought that the words were very, very good, and the tune was very good, and the voice was very, very good. And that particular compound, that triangle, which is often, though not always, an equilateral triangle, pointless to say, are the words more important than the music, or the voice more important than the words and the music? It is, as I've said somewhere, like asking whether the oxygen is more important than the hydrogen in water. It's a compound. You need them all, so it doesn't make sense to say which is important. The words of a song need to be as good as the words of a poem or a novel or a play, excepting only that they're not going to be the only thing that conveys that which the work of art realizes for us.
Maybe let's listen to the song that first got your attention. Then, Now, Forever, Desolation Row.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlors filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row. Cinderella, she seems so easy. It takes one little one, she smiles and puts her hands into her back pocket, Betty Davis style. And in comes Romeo, he's mourning. He belonged to me, I believe. Someone turns and says to him, my friend, you'd better leave. And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go is Cinderella sweeping up on desolation road.
Remember it for us, your first hearing and what you're hearing today.
Well, what I hear today has a lot to do with a stronger sense than I would have had at first of the great imaginings that it belongs among, that it belongs with the wasteland. It belongs with a vision by which, in a way that's partly poem and partly film, things glide before you as though you're in a dream or in a nightmare. But as in a good dream or nightmare, there are bits of it that are perfectly simply, factually straightforward. They're selling postcards of the hanging. They did that. Hanging is lynching. And those terrible postcards, what culture was this? One wishes it were surrealist. Wouldn't it be wonderful if selling postcards of the hanging were only a surrealist sickness? No, no, it was the American way of life. It was quite central. So then you move into these things that are surrealist, all right. They're painting the passports brown. Oh, that's painting the town red. And the town is going to turn up a moment later in the song. So you've got the strange feeling that you often have in a dream that there's a word just below the surface. There's some sort of link. Is the blind commissioner a commissioner who's blind or a commissioner for the blind? It's blind partly because you're visualizing things. Sound wonderfully visualizes. You can't visualize and see at the same time. Betty Davis isn't imaginary, but she's in the business of imagining and so on. Mm. You're prompted to think about films, a great narrative which depends on a scale that you might associate with a film. It's a surrealist song. Surrealism looks much easier to do than it really is. Dylan uses it up after a while.
Ophelia, she's neath the window. For her, I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid. Now to her, death is quite romantic. She wears an iron vest. Her profession is her religion. Her sin is her lifelessness. And though her eyes are fixed upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into desolation.
What did people do before surrealism turned up? Mm-hmm. They thought about madness. Ophelia says things all the time that are surrealist. They say the owl was a baker's daughter. And the sensible reaction to that is, yes, you're absolutely right, and back away slightly nervously and keep away from this woman. Don't make eye contact with her. So this thing of the terrible madness that unfulfillment brings to people.
You hear not only a song you like, but you hear him talking about Pound and Eliot.
That the song is like the wasteland is much more important than that it mentions T.S. Eliot. Mm. And indeed, the verse about T.S. Eliot, he has over the years often dropped. Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower while Calypso singers laugh at them. There was a long period where he didn't sing that verse at all, as though he would too much think, you've been with the professors. I remember being told that it was somehow brave of us to talk about popular music. The brave thing 30, 40 years ago would have been to talk about the poetry of Sir Walter Scott, much braver than talking about the Beatles, because the academic profession was already trying to suck up to young people.
Praise be to Nero's Neptune. The Titanic sails at dawn. Everybody's shouting, which side are you on? And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower while Calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers. Between the windows of the sea where lovely mermaids flow, and nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row.
Please.
Well, I think I'd go first to the way in which he sings the name T.S. Eliot. And Dylan gets a wonderful... slightly acid precision into saying that, singing that, T.S. Eliot. And that contrasted throughout with the open sound that's the sound of Desolation Row. It's sardonic, but very respectful, because we all know where those mermaids come from. Those mermaids come from Mr. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, where the mermaids are crucial at the penultimate moment of the poem.
Mm-hmm. Carry on the Titanic and what they're arguing about. Which side are you on?
Now, the idea that modernism was like the Titanic, this huge, wonderful, luxury thing that was setting out and was doomed in the United States of America, which side are you on, has become the most important question there is. It's the great protest song. Well, Dylan puts capital letters and quotation marks around that to remind us that there are an immense number of political and social realities where it can't be which side are you on. And that was the point in my back pages. I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. He moves towards phrasing which intimates that it won't be as clear as you might have wished. Mm. Don't fear if you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It does sound like somebody for whom English is not a native language. But Dylan's wonderful, wonderful device is just change the preposition and see the difference that it makes again and again and again. These words that it's easy to be snobbish about, and if and but. William James says very beautifully, we should have a feeling of if and a feeling of but, as we have a feeling of blue and of cold. These are words which are immensely valuable, and the art of a song like If Not For You is that words if not for would seem to be just lying out there waiting for anybody to do what they like with them, and it doesn't feel as if they could be of any force at all. But how wonderful, if not for you.
If not for you.
Coming up, Bob Dylan's account of his own lifetime in music. It begins with the legends, Buddy Holly and Leadbelly. But if you really want to know, his art goes back to Homer. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Giving Bob Dylan his due as a literary man with Christopher Ricks. You may be the father of the Nobel Prize here, but of the notion that Bob Dylan is a poet, a conscious poet, a great poet.
I'm not the father of it. Lots and lots of people had written about how extraordinary Dylan's power over words can be. The Nobel Prize is tricky because, as we all know, there is no Nobel Prize for music or for song or for acting, which is one of the great ways in which words come home to us. Do I think that literature is what Dylan creates, contributes to? Well, being a genius with words would seem to me to establish a claim. If by poet you mean somebody who's very, very good with words, then he's a poet. But then so is Samuel Beckett in his prose. So is Shakespeare in his prose.
Can I quote William James, as you quoted him in your book, writing about Shakespeare, said the great William James, he seems to me to have been a professional amuser in the first instance, with a productivity like that of a Dumas or a scribe, but possessing what no other amuser has possessed, a lyric splendor added to his rhetorical fluency, which has made people take him for a more essentially serious human being than he was. Was James patronizing Shakespeare?
The condescension is that Shakespeare, unlike my brother Henry, is not really a serious figure. But William James has no idea whether Shakespeare was a serious human being. We know almost nothing about Shakespeare as a human being. But the word amuser is clearly, I mean, it was like saying there's a category mistake. The latest issue of the New Criterion knows the Nobel people have made a category mistake. Dylan is just an amuser, okay? I've given people this crazy idea that Dylan is an artist of depth and width and range and power. I think he's a genius. The relation of that to amusement? Well, T.S. Eliot says poems have to be entertaining. That book is good in vain, which the reader throws away.
Let's talk about who else you were listening to besides Bob Dylan?
Of course, I liked the Beatles very much. I liked James Taylor very much. I liked the Doors. Mm. I liked Cream. The music that my mother loved, I loved too, like Pale Hands I loved, Beside the Shalimar, or Over the Wings of a Dove.
I love those. My mother, in her 90s, would sing Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes, and it was, you know, just pure magic.
It is a great song and distinguishable from a great song. I mean, that is, Ben Jonson writes the poem, right, and that we have it very, very beautifully set is a glory. And it is different from the glory that is, let's say, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, where the thing is written to be a song.
Williams and Zinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore hotel society gathering, and the cops was called in, and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked Williams and Zinger for first-degree murder. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Williams and Zinger, who had 24 years, owns a tobacco farm of 600 acres with rich, wealthy parents who provide and protect him, and high office relations in the politics of Maryland reacted to his deed with a shrug of his shoulders and swear words and sneering, and his tongue it was a snarling. And in a matter of minutes, on bail was out walking. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears.
Tragedy unfolding here in a trial in Baltimore.
Well, it starts, I mean, like all the people who value fantasy and imagining, Dylan has a great sense of fact. It was what T.S. Eliot said you had to have to be a poet, to be a writer. You have a sense of fact. These are the names of the actual people. The woman who struck over the head is Hattie Carroll. The man who strikes her over the head is Williams and Zinger. And the names happen to have unstressed final syllables. So the name Hattie Carroll is stressed on the first syllable, not on the second. Zanzinger is stressed on the second syllable, but not on the final syllable. So you've got feminine endings, unstressed final syllables. Now that gave Dylan the rhythm for the whole song. William Zanzinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled round his diamond ring finger, and the cops were called in and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked William Zanzinger for first-degree murder. Now, if he'd been booked for rape, the cadence wouldn't have been the same. It's that unstressed final syllable which is then resisted by the refrain. The refrain is all masculine endings. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears.
Now ain't the time for your tears. Hattie Carroll was a maid in the kitchen. She was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children who carried the dishes and took out the garbage and never sat once at the head of the table and didn't even talk to the people at the table who just cleaned up all the food from the table and emptied the ashtrays on a whole other level. Got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane that sailed through the air and came down through the room, doomed and determined to destroy all the gentle. And she never done nothing to Williams and Zinger.
The terrible monotony of the table, the table.
Yes,
the table.
Three lines.
And then the level. And then the reminder that her name is Carol, which picks it up as if it were rhyming. The only moment in the narrative at which it stops having this particular cadence is the moment when she's hit over the head. Got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane that sailed through the air and came down through the room. Not came down through the lobby, down through the chamber. Not killed by a truncheon. There's an amputation of a syllable there, and it's the moment when somebody's hit over the head and she dies from it. All you do is fall short by a syllable. And in that moment, something appalling happens.
The spectral presence of Cain and Abel.
Well, it's because he got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane. Cain, as the first killer, turns up in many of Dylan's songs. So the question is, when you sing a word like Cain, it's identical in sound with C-A-I-N. And when you have table, 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 are you near Abel?
Ah.
In the courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded and that even the nobles get properly handled once that the cops have chased after and caught 'em. And that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom. Stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak most deep and distinguished, and handed out strongly for penalty and repentance Williams and Zinger with a 6-month sentence. But you who philosophize discreet and criticize all fears, bury the rain deep in your face, for now's the time for your tears.
Well, it moves to that final sentence, handed out strongly for penalty and repentance, William Zanzinger with a 6-month sentence. And all Dylan does is lengthen the word er to a, so it's not with a, can you believe it? This person got away with a six-month sentence. Of course, it's one of the great things in art to call up all the things you're not going to mention. This song never says she's black. You know she's black. You know it for sure. You would bet your shirt that she was
made
black.
In the kitchen.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, the things left out. To me, it's horrifyingly wonderful that kill is an intransitive verb. Stared at the person who killed for no reason. The line could have been stared at the person who killed Hattie Carroll. She's no longer, in some terrible way, the issue. She isn't the issue. The time for your tears was not back then when this terrible thing happened, but when this terrible thing is treated as if it weren't terrible. At the one occasion on which I met the man I still think of as Mr. Dylan in many ways, he asked, "Do you like that song?" I said, "I think it's perfect."
My word. Can I say, Christopher Ricks, it's music of a sort to hear you unpacking the art that goes into all of these songs. But Dylan, in his Chronicles, Volume 1, rejoices in this picture of himself as a song and dance man. Reminds me of James Joyce referring to himself as basically a cut-and-paste guy. Place him in your own tradition. Does he remind you of anybody? Does he have a father other than Woody Guthrie? And the French poets and all those other sources he cites.
What I know about tends to be poems. When John Donne writes, "Come, madam, come, all rest my powers defy. Until I labour, I in labour lie." To his mistress going to bed. "Come, madam, come, lay, lady, lay." And the Donne poem has, "Until I labour, I in labour lie. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big crossbed."
Stay with your man and wow.
talks about Dunn, he talks about Keats. Tarantula is full of very, very good literary jokes about the people that he has read and engaged with and feels ruefully at odds with or ruefully at one with. April or so is a cruel month. That does to Eliot what Eliot did to all of other people. Take some words, change the rhythm, raise a question about time. Why can I say, I'll see you at noon or so, but I can't say, I'll see you in April or so? And it's very like what Eliot does with When Lovely Woman Stoops to Folly, and just move and back, and you've really changed the Goldsmith line. Somebody said to me once that I was hard of listening. Dylan is not hard of listening. He's a terrifically good listener, and he listens to poems that he reads on the page, it seems to me, with great acuteness.
With your mercury mouth in the missionary times, and your eyes like smoke, and your prayers like rhymes, and your silver cross, and your voice like chimes. Oh, who do they think could bury you? With your pockets well protected at last, and your street car visions which you place on the grass, and your flesh like silk, and your face like glass. Who could they get to carry you? Sad eyed lady of the lowlands, where the sad eyed prophet says that no man comes. My warehouse eyes, my Arabian drums. Should I put them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
With your sheep. Amazing writing, and as I look at it again, it's just so complexly or neatly put together.
Well, this is like a huge Petrarchan poem. It's like four, six sonnets by Petrarch, every one of which lists all the wonderful apparatus which surrounds a seductive woman. The song overlaps terrifically with Swinburne's poem of Dolores, where Dolores is Our Lady of Sorrows, the sad-eyed lady of the lowlands. So if you want a great poem which simply keeps talking about all the things that you have, which I am both thrilled by and frightened by, it is about femme fatale, and it too is in touch with that whole surrealist world. What is a mercury mouth? Which kind of mercury? Because mercury had a power to cure disease, but it is also poisonous.
Sure.
And there's something about with your, which is trying to resist all of that.
With your childhood flames on your midnight rug, and your Spanish manners, and your mother's drugs, and your cowboy mouth.
And then there are these other people who believe that they can deal with you.
Who among them do you think could resist you?
The rhyme scheme is one which is always giving you a line which is biding its time. It starts with a triplet that goes times, rhymes, chimes. Times, rhymes and chimes, rhyme and chime, because they come several times. You're saying, please notice what's happening. It then, though, gives you the line which waits. Oh, who do they think could bury you is going to wait for another triplet. Then you go last, grass, glass, and its answer is another question. So the story is, who do they think could bury you? Who could they get to carry you? Who among them can think he could outguess you? Who among them will try to impress you? Who among them really wants just to kiss you? Who among them do you think could resist you? I mean, there's a lovely intonation in it. How could they ever mistake you? How could they ever have persuaded you? And at that point, it's as if some of the onus moves. And finally, who among them do you think would employ you? Who among them could ever think he could destroy you?
Could ever think he could destroy you?
So the narrative is in these lines which are waiting. The refrain is a very great beauty, I think, and great dignity. Should I leave them by her gate, or sad-eyed lady, should I wait? Should I wait is like Shakespeare's sonnets, where the speaker in the sonnets is always saying, please, I'm perfectly happy to wait, with a terrific edge of resentment. And this is a song which understands resentment. That is it. Terrific song. Terrifying song, really.
Should I leave them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
Coming up, the So What Does It All Mean question and Bob Dylan's answer. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Here, finally, is a taste of the Nobel message that Bob Dylan laid down this week.
When I received the Nobel Prize for Literature, I got to wondering exactly how my songs related to literature. I wanted to reflect on it and see where the connection was. I'm going to try to articulate that to you, and most likely it will go in a roundabout way. But I hope what I say will be worthwhile and purposeful.
His inspiration goes back to Homer in Greek antiquity, he says, but his vocation kicked in when he was 18, and his idol, Buddy Holly, soon to die in a plane crash, looked out from the stage at young Dylan, right straight, dead in the eye, as if to say, you take it from here. Then quickly, Leadbelly, another legend, turned Dylan away from radio songs of the 1950s toward folk world and the road, because they felt vibrant, Dylan says, and truthful to life.
By listening to all the early folk artists and singing the songs yourself, you pick up the vernacular, you internalize it, you sing it in the ragtime blues, work songs, Georgia C. Shanties, the Appalachian ballads and cowboy songs. You hear all the finer points and you learn the details. You know what it's all about, taking a pistol out, putting it back in your pocket, whipping your way through traffic, talking in the dark. You know that Steiger Lee was a bad man and that Frankie was a good girl. You know that Washington is a bourgeois town and you heard the deep-pitched voice of John the Revelator and you saw the Titanic sink in a boggy creek and your pals with the wild Irish rover and the wild colonial boy. You heard the muffled drums and the fifes that played lowly. You've seen the lusty Lord Donald stick a knife in his wife, and a lot of your comrades have been wrapped in white linen. I had all the vernacular down. I knew the rhetoric. None of it went over my head. The devices, the techniques, the secrets, the mysteries, and I knew all the deserted roads that it traveled on too. I could make it all connect and move with the current of the day. When I started writing my own songs, the folk lingo was the only vocabulary that I knew, and I used it. But I had something else as well. I had principles and sensibilities and an informed view of the world, and I had had that for a while. Learned it all in grammar school, Don Quixote, Ivanhoe, Robinson Crusoe, Gulliver's Travels, Tale of Two Cities, all the rest. Typical grammar school reading that gave you a way of looking at life, an understanding of human nature, and a standard to measure things by. I took all that with me when I started composing lyrics, and the themes from those books worked their way into many of my songs, either knowingly or unintentionally. I wanted to write songs unlike anything anybody ever heard, and these themes were fundamental. Specific books that have stuck with me ever since I read them way back in grammar school. I want to tell you about three of them. Moby Dick, All Quiet on the Western Front, and the Odyssey. Moby Dick is a fascinating book, a book that's filled with scenes of high drama and dramatic dialogue. The book makes demands on you. The plot is straightforward. The mysterious Captain Ahab, captain of a ship called the Pequod, an egomaniac with a peg leg, pursuing his nemesis, the great white whale Moby Dick, who took his leg. And he pursues him all the way from the Atlantic, around the tip of Africa, and into the Indian Ocean. He pursues the whale around both sides of the earth. It's an abstract goal, nothing concrete or definite. He calls Moby the Emperor, sees him as the embodiment of evil. Ahab's got a wife and child back in Nantucket that he reminisces about now and again. You can anticipate what will happen. The ship's crew is made up of men of different races, and any one of them who sights the whale will be given the reward of a gold coin. A lot of zodiac symbols, religious allegory, stereotypes. Ahab encounters other whaling vessels, presses the captains for details about Moby. Have they seen him? There's a crazy prophet, Gabriel, on one of the vessels, and he predicts Ahab's doom. Says Moby is the incarnate of a Shaker god, and that any dealings with him will lead to disaster. He says that to Captain Ahab. Another ship's captain, Captain Boomer, he lost an arm to Moby, but he tolerates that, and he's happy to have survived. He can't accept Ahab's lust for vengeance. This book tells how different men react in different ways to the same experience. A lot of Old Testament biblical allegory. Gabriel, Rachel, Jeroboam, Bildad, Elijah, pagan names as well. Tashtego, Flask, Dagu, Fleece, Stubbuck, Stub, Martha's Vineyard. The pagans are idol worshippers. Some worship little wax figures, some wooden figures. Some worship fire. The Pequod is the name of an Indian tribe. Moby Dick is a seafaring tale. One of the men, the narrator, says, "Call me Ishmael." Somebody asks him where he's from. He says, "It's not down on any map. True places never are." Stubb gives no significance to anything. Says everything is predestined. Ishmael's been on a sailing ship his entire life. Calls the sailing ships his Harvard and Yale. He keeps his distance from people. Everything is mixed in. All the myths, the Judeo-Christian Bible, Hindu myths, British legends, St. George, Perseus, Hercules, they're all whalers. Greek mythology, the gory business of cutting up a whale. Lots of facts in this book. Geographical knowledge, whale oil, good for coronation of royalty, noble families in the whaling industry. Whale oil is used to anoint the kings, history of the whale, phrenology, classical philosophy, pseudo-scientific theories, justification for discrimination, everything thrown in, and none of it hardly rational. Highbrow, lowbrow, chasing illusion, chasing death. The great white whale, white as a polar bear, white as a white man, the emperor, the nemesis, the embodiment of evil. The demented captain who actually lost his leg years ago, trying to attack Moby with a knife. We see only the surface of things. We can interpret what lies below any way we see fit. Crewmen walk around on deck listening for mermaids, and sharks and vultures follow the ship, reading skulls and faces like you read a book. Here's a face. I put it in front of you. Read it if you can. Finally, Ahab spots Moby, and the harpoons come out. Boats our Lord. Ahab's harpoon has been baptized in blood. Moby attacks Ahab's boat and destroys it. Next day he sights Moby again. Boats our Lord again. Moby attacks Ahab's boat again. On a third day, another boat goes in. More religious allegory. He has risen. Moby attacks one more time, ramming the Pequod and sinking it. Ahab gets tangled up in the harpoon lines and is thrown out of his boat into a watery grave. Ishmael survives. He's in the sea floating on a coffin. And that's about it. That's the whole story. That theme and all that it implies would work its way into more than a few of my songs. All Quiet on the Western Front was another book that did. All Quiet on the Western Front is a horror story. This is a book where you lose your childhood, your faith in a meaningful world, and your concern for individuals. You're stuck in a nightmare, sucked up into a mysterious whirlpool of death and pain. You're defending yourself from elimination. You're being wiped off the face of the map. Once upon a time, you were an innocent youth with big dreams about being a concert pianist. Once you loved life and the world, and now you're shooting it to pieces. I put this book down and closed it up. I never wanted to read another war novel again, and I never did. Charlie Poole from North Carolina had a song that connected to all this. It's called You Ain't Talking to Me, and the lyrics go like this. I saw a sign in the window walking uptown one day. Join the army, see the world is what it had to say. You'll see exciting places with a jolly crew. You'll meet interesting people and learn to kill them too. Oh, you ain't talking to me. You ain't talking to me. I may be crazy and all that, but I got good sense, you see. You ain't talking to me. You ain't talking to me. Killing with a gun don't sound like fun. You ain't talking to me. The Odyssey is a great book whose themes have worked its way into the ballads of a lot of songwriters. Homeward Bound, Green Green Grass of Home, Home on the Range, and my songs as well. The Odyssey is a strange, adventurous tale of a grown man trying to get home after fighting in a war. He's on that long journey home, and it's filled with traps and pitfalls. He's cursed to wander. He's always getting carried out to sea, always having close calls. Huge chunks of boulders rock his boat. He angers people he shouldn't. There's troublemakers in his crew. Treachery. His men are turned into pigs, and then they're turned back into younger, more handsome men. He's always trying to rescue somebody. He's a traveling man, but he's making a lot of stops. He's stranded on a desert island. He finds deserted caves, and he hides in them. He meets giants that say, I'll eat you last. And he escapes from giants. He's trying to get back home, but he's tossed and turned by the winds. Restless winds, chilly winds, unfriendly winds. He travels far, and then he gets blown back. He's always being warned of things to come, touching things he's told not to. There's two roads to take, and they're both bad, both hazardous. On one you could drown, and on the other you could starve. He goes into the narrow straits with foaming whirlpools that swallow him. Meets six-headed monsters with sharp fangs. Thunderbolts strike at him. Overhanging branches that he makes a leap to reach for to save himself from a raging river. Goddesses and gods protect him, but some others want to kill him. He changes identities. He's exhausted. He falls asleep, and he's woken up by the sound of laughter. He tells his story to strangers. He's been gone 20 years. He was carried off somewhere and left there. Drugs have been dropped into his wine. It's been a hard road to travel. In a lot of ways, some of these same things have happened to you. You too have had drugs dropped into your wine. You too have shared a bed with the wrong woman. You too have been spellbound by magical voices, sweet voices with strange melodies. You too have come so far and have been so far blown back. And you've had close calls as well. You have angered people you should not have. And you too have rambled this country all around. And you've also felt that ill wind, the wind that blows you no good. And that's still not all of it. When he gets back home, things aren't any better. Scoundrels have moved in and are taking advantage of his wife's hospitality. And there's too many of them. And though he's greater than them all, and the best at everything, best carpenter, best hunter, best expert on animals, best seaman, his courage won't save him. But his trickery will. All these stragglers will have to pay for desecrating his palace. He'll disguise himself as a filthy beggar, and a lowly servant kicks him down the steps with arrogance and stupidity. The servant's arrogance revolts him, but he controls his anger. He's 1 against 100, but they'll all fall, even the strongest. He was nobody, and when it's all said and done, when he's home at last, he sits with his wife, and he tells her the stories. So what does it all mean? Myself and a lot of other songwriters have been influenced by these very same themes. And they can mean a lot of different things. If a song moves you, that's all that's important. I don't have to know what a song means. I've written all kinds of things into my songs, and I'm not going to worry about it, what it all means. When Melville put all his Old Testament biblical references, scientific theories, Protestant doctrines, and all that knowledge of the sea and sailing ships and whales into one story, I don't think he would have worried about it either, what it all means. John Donne as well, the poet priest who lived in the time of Shakespeare, wrote these words, "The sestos and abidos of her breasts, not of two lovers, but two loves, the nests." I don't know what it means either, but it sounds good, and you want your songs to sound good. When Odysseus in the Odyssey visits the famed warrior Achilles in the underworld, Achilles, who traded a long life full of peace and contentment for a short one full of honor and glory, tells Odysseus, "There was all a mistake. I just died, that's all. There was no honor, no immortality, and that if he could, he would choose to go back and be a lowly slave to a tenant farmer on earth rather than be what he is, a king in the land of the dead." That whatever his struggles of life were, they were preferable to being here in this dead place. And that's what songs are too. Our songs are alive in the land of the living. But songs are unlike literature. They're meant to be sung, not read. The words in Shakespeare's plays were meant to be acted on the stage, just as lyrics and songs are meant to be sung, not read on a page. And I hope some of you get the chance to listen to these lyrics the way they were intended to be heard, in concert or on record, or however people are listening to songs these days. I return once again to Homer, who says, "Sing in me, O muse, and through me tell the story."
That was Bob Dylan reading the traditional Nobel acceptance speech, but recording it Dylan style. He sent along a written version, too. And once again, this is Professor Christopher Ricks. Christopher Ricks was aware over the years that Bob Dylan was reading him, and then, finally, they met.
Phone rang. "Bob Dylan is coming to Boston, would like to meet you." So Judith and I went backstage half an hour before the concert, and I shall never forget it.
And he said?
He said, "Mr. Ricks, we meet at last." Which really was wasn't quite a wonderful thing to say. I mean, I hadn't published a book. I'd written about him in the Three Penny Review, and I'd given a radio talk and thing of that kind. I'd been brought up to say, if you don't know what to say to people, you say, "Read any good books lately?" So I said, "Read any good books lately?" And he said, "Richard III." And we talked a little bit about Richard III and so on. And then after 10 or 15 minutes, I said, "This has been an honour and a pleasure." And I shook him by the hand and left. Next to my meeting twice Samuel Beckett, it's the being in the room with somebody that I'm most pleased with. And I've been pacing up and down by the phone ever since, wondering whether he will phone me.
Thank you, Christopher Ricks. His book about the lyrics of Bob Dylan is called Dylan's Visions of Sin. Our show was produced, edited, and mixed by George Hicks. Thank you, George. He had help from Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Susan Coyne, and Becca DiGregorio. Thanks also to Michael Leiden, brother and music coach all these years. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.
I punched myself in the face with my fist. I took my potatoes down to be mashed, and I made it on over.